Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hope everyone is having a great start to their long Labor Day weekend. I'll be brief with a couple quick show notes before we get into this episode. Number one, we'd love folks to continue clicking subscribe to our Supercast. It's how we support our show. It's how we expand. It's how we get you all your bonus content. That's realignment.supercast.com. Once again, realignment.supercast.com, or you can click the link in your show notes or in the description if you're watching this on YouTube. $5 a month, $50 a year, $500 for a lifetime membership. Number two, this episode is going to talk about a book that's recently come out. So if you want to support the show and also support authors, you can go to our bookshop storefront, which is also linked. Finally, it's Friday, so the Substack is coming back. Took a bit of a break because of the end of August month, but if you'd like to get the written version of the show and get additional content that way, click the show notes link as well too. Last but not least, today's episode, I'm incredibly interested in the topic of energy, not only because I recently bought my first car, but also because it's at the top of everyone's mind with the war in Ukraine, with gas prices, with the debate over nuclear power, all these different topics that we've hit a bunch of different times during the show. So I brought on Catherine Blunt. She is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She has a new book out. It's called California Burning, The Fall of Pacific Gas and Electric, and What It Means for America's Power Grid. So hope you all enjoy this conversation. And it is but the start of our coverage of energy topics. All that said, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Hope you all have a great weekend. See you next week. Catherine Blunt, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congrats on the book. As we mentioned before the start of the episode, I really enjoyed it. Can't recommend it enough. I just kind of want to start with an obvious question, though. It seems insane that we're even having this conversation because at a fundamental level, it doesn't make sense that our energy infrastructure, insert statement, the U.S. is the richest country in the world, would be so bad. Yeah. We all know, like, the airplane anecdotal, our airports look bad. But at the end of the day, like, that's aesthetic. But this is actually lives, basic functions, billions of dollars of economic activity at risk. So what's your telling of why things are so bad in a way that doesn't make any sense?
Yeah, well, I mean, most basically, the grid is very old. I mean, there are parts of the grid that were built prior to World War II. And, you know, it's different companies have different ways of maintaining this infrastructure, and some do much better than others. But at the end of the day, it's extremely old infrastructure, and it's becoming more prone to failure as the climate changes. And we're seeing, you know, more extreme weather events linked to climate change. And we're getting ready for a period in which there's going to be greater electricity demand for the first time in a long time as we add more EVs to the system and do more to electrify our homes. So it's a huge challenge. And I think it's fair to say that there has been underinvestment in certain types of energy infrastructure over a long period of time for a number of different reasons, but we're beginning to see the consequences of that.
Question would be, and I think you just alluded to this, why would there be underinvestment in basic functions like capacity? You'd think this would be like the obvious place to start when it comes to these bits.
Yeah. There's a lot of different sort of ways of thinking about this. I guess if you're thinking about the power plants themselves, there are certain there's a number of different competitive power markets throughout the country, and they all have different market designs, but a lot of them essentially reward the lowest cost operator. And there's been, I think, especially within the last several years, a real challenge has emerged for certain owners of more expensive plants who aren't seeing the kinds of profits they used to see anymore. And as a result, they haven't been investing as much in maintaining the safety and the adequate operation of the facility. When we're thinking about power lines, you know, let's think about transmission lines. Transmission lines are some of the oldest parts of the grid. These are high voltage wires that carry electricity from power plants. You know, replacing them or building new ones has been challenging historically. You've got, you know, a lot of local opposition to these types of energy projects. It's very, it's expensive, capital intensive, requires a lot of different issues, permitting, land use, all that. And so as a result, we're, I think, very reliant on the system as it was built 100 years ago, you know? And then if we're talking about kind of the grid as a whole, when you think about the ways utilities make money, they make money on large capital investments on which they earn a regulated rate of return. They do not make money on operations and maintenance, just sort of day-to-day expenses needed to keep power lines running. And so, you know, to different degrees and for different reasons, you've seen some underspending on certain power lines throughout the country.
I want to kind of pick apart the terms here. You mentioned lowest cost operators, but aren't these usually just utility monopolies? So like, how does that structure work?
Yeah, so in some places, like notably the Southeast, utilities are still vertically integrated monopolies. So they control power generation, power transmission, and power distribution. That's not the case in most other places, not the case in Texas, not the case in California, not the case in much of the Mid-Atlantic and some of the West. So basically, there was a push in the 1990s and early 2000s to deregulate the electricity business. And essentially what that meant is that the generation of power was, it was given to the free market, in which you have competition among power plant owners to provide electricity, and then the utilities buy that wholesale, just transmit it and distribute it.
I think the question would be, I'm curious what you think about this as a, analyst. We hear about the, laboratories of democracy argument, different systems should win out. Like, if we're looking at how there's different systems in the Mid-Atlantic, the Southeast, California, Texas, et cetera, where are we seeing systems that are just most effective at doing what I think we all want, which is I turn on the light and the light works and there isn't a massive fire because there's a 1920s era tiny piece of machinery. And we'll get into that thing I just referenced in a second, but what systems are we seeing the most do the job the best?
Yeah. So from a market perspective, it's a tough question to answer because each design has some benefits as well as some flaws. So one of the most purely competitive power market in the United States is in Texas, in which truly, the lowest cost power wins out consistently. And the idea is that power plant owners, whether that be an owner of a wind farm and a solar farm or a gas plant or a coal plant, is paid just for the energy that they produce. They're not paid any sort of premium to make sure that that capacity is available when it's needed. And you saw the kind of disastrous effects of that during the 2021 Texas freeze, in which power plants of all kinds failed, in part because of underinvestment in certain infrastructure, in part because there was issues with natural gas delivery. So when I say underinvestment, what I mean is these power plant operators hadn't prepared for extreme cold temperatures like Texas saw during that week, because it was so, they considered it so unlikely to happen. Why spend that additional money to be prepared for that? And, so in the Mid-Atlantic, by contrast, power plant operators are paid that premium to make sure that they're available when they're needed. It's called a capacity payment. They're basically paid to operate on standby. There's a lot of criticism of that model over the years because it's more expensive. But in the wake of the freeze, everyone looked at it and said, well, maybe this is the way to go. But another challenge of that is that, generally speaking, it's a construct that benefits more often than not natural gas power plants and coal-fired power plants, because those are plants that can start up on demand, unlike a wind farm or a solar farm. There are some efforts to change that, do more to incorporate batteries, but that's another conversation to have as we try to address climate change and move to cleaner energy.
So let's move to the actual story here. Yeah. I think it does a great job of zooming in, and then we could zoom out from that because there's an obvious metaphor there. So here's the obvious question. How is it possible that PG&E, a utility that has this seemingly virtual monopoly on the fifth biggest economy in the world, right, that being California, if it were its own country by itself, how could that entity possibly go bankrupt? It seems like if you were to construct a situation where you cannot possibly lose, it seems like California would be it. So let's really get into that part.
Totally. It's remarkable. Utility bankruptcies happen so infrequently. They're all but guaranteed the ability to produce revenue and profits. So to understand why PG&E found itself in such dire financial straits after these fires, it's worth noting that in California, there's a certain liability construct in which utilities are financially liable for damages resulting from fire sparked by their equipment, regardless if they're negligent, is known as inverse condemnation, and it creates a very substantial financial risk, not only for PG&E, but for the other large utilities in the state as well. And so after the 2017 and 2018 fires, which were, just for listeners, it was about 20 of them, more than 100 people died in total, the company faced about $30 billion in liability costs as a result of these disasters. And it said, we are going to seek bankruptcy protection in order to effectively sort through them. There was debate about whether it needed to sort through them, but needed to resort to bankruptcy protection to do this, but it ultimately did. And it was a really, really complicated restructuring.
Here's a question then. If California has this system where they're held liable for these fires, whether it's like negligent or not, wouldn't that incentivize not having such dilapidated infrastructure in the first place? Like, where's the gap there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's actually a question I've not been asked before, and you'd think so. I mean, you'd think it would be enough of a deterrent, so to speak. But I think one of the issues is that historically speaking, especially over the last 10 years or so, PG&E just dramatically underestimated the risk profile of its service territory, because climate change had made it so that the consequence of a single spark from a power line was so much higher than it used to be, because millions of trees had died as a result of drought exacerbated by climate change. And its service territory became risky in a way that had never been before. And the company over time had reduced the thoroughness of its inspections to the point where it wasn't fully aware of the risk of equipment failure as it was presented after, as it presented itself in the wake of these disasters. So I think it's, to some degree, the answer is ignorance.
So yeah, I guess my confusion was premised on this idea that it's like SimCity, and you know, PG&E has this like total perception of everything that's kind of happening. I guess the question would be then, I'd like you to actually talk about what causes the campfire blaze, because once again, like, this is such a complicated area of policy and energy and all these bits, but what actually goes down is so simple. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what makes this such a tragedy, but just like what actually happened here, in terms of the actual like cause of the fire and the direct aftermath.
Yeah. So it was a transmission tower that failed. It was one of those tall lattice structures that support high voltage power lines. And you know, high voltage wires hang suspended from the arms of their towers in order to keep the live wires away from the metal, or else you have a risk of arcing and sparking and, very dangerous. It's a dangerous mode of failure. And so what happened on the morning of November 8th, 2018, is that there was a very strong windstorm. There was a hook hanging from the arm of a tower supporting a high voltage wire. The hook was about the width of a fist. And it was, as it was swinging in the wind, it broke nearly in half, dropping the wire. An arc of electricity surged in the wire to the tower. Sparks settled on the dry brush beneath the tower, and the fire within, moments, within an hour, it was completely out of control. The conditions were such, between the dry conditions and the wind, it was spreading toward the town of Paradise with like unimaginable speed. There was no way to get ahead of it.
I think the question then would be, what lessons have other utilities taken from the large judgment? Because there's this theme that comes up in your Wall Street Journal reporting too, which is, wow, this is unprecedented. We weren't ready for this. All these different bits. It seems that at this point of the game, especially 2 years post, COVID pandemic outbreak, we're deep in that period where we should just expect the unexpected now. How do you kind of see the industry just changing like mentally when it comes to that?
Yeah. So a lot of utilities across the country are beginning to recognize the new risks throughout the system. A lot of them are proposing very large spending plans to address some of these risks. A lot of them explicitly mention climate change at this point. And so I think that the spending plans are kind of predicated on two ideas. One, that the infrastructure is old and a lot of it needs to be replaced, especially as new risks emerge. The other part of it, as we were discussing earlier, is that electricity demand is expected to increase. We need to strengthen the grid to support this new demand as more people drive electric vehicles, as more people phase out their gas systems within their homes and use electric stoves and other things. That said, though, I think that the extent of the understanding varies among companies. And I think there are some that are really just beginning to come to terms with it and others that are more forward looking and have been thinking about this for longer. So it will be interesting to see the differences in the ways these risks are addressed and when as we go forward.
And what is, I struggle to say like advice because you're a reporter, but I'll just ask it anyways. What is your just sort of general advice to folks who live in parts of the country with these sort of like climate induced risks? Like when you're moving, you know, then this is, you know, and once again, you tell the story like very well, but you know, a lot of these victims are elderly. So, you know, when you purchase this house in the 70s, 80s, like 90s, like you're not looking at the same risk profile. Right. When it came to this type of situation, I'm sure younger persons, when they're deciding to move to these places, are having to factor this in now. Like, how should people just be thinking about living in parts of the country like that?
Yeah, well, in California, obviously, the risk is very acute in that you have high threat fire areas in more places. There's all kinds of, you know, advice as it relates to maintaining defensible space so that if a fire is burning close to your house, there's less of a likelihood that it will actually burn your structure because it can be kept off by, you know, things that are not non-flammable material, essentially. And so that's for example, that's you see more people doing that and being aware of the fact that they need to, talking to their neighbors about it. And then in other places, you know, I think about more intense hurricanes on, you know, the Gulf Coast and the East Coast. I mean, there's some flooding risk associated with that. There's clearly wind risk associated with that. And there's, you know, certain mitigation measures that you can take to address that. But when I think about something like the Texas freeze, it was seemingly unfathomable. You know, I don't know how you necessarily prepare for that other than to have a good disaster plan in place and enough, you know, materials to get you through any sort of condition, whether it be, I mean, in the case of Texas, extreme heat or extreme cold, it seems. And so it's tough. I mean, there's a certain number of preventative measures that can be taken depending on the risk and what seems to be becoming more extreme as a result of these changes. But like you said earlier, some of it is like, we should expect the unexpected. And I don't know how you fully prepare for that.
This is kind of going back to the conversation, the way I started our conversation, but I'll just ask it in this bit here too. I'm a podcaster. I look at books. I look at like what the headlines are that kind of shapes like the narrative and the zeitgeist that people are really thinking about. And just this grid conversation has been a part of that narrative zeitgeist for like 10 years. Mm-hmm. Plenty of books on this topic, like all these different bits, folks like yourself. It seems though that this narrative like just hasn't really moved. It seems like we're just going to perpetually be talking about America has a overwrought, overworn grid, and there's something we need to vaguely do about it. Is that like an accurate perception of like the past 10 years? Or am I just missing the fact that there are all these on the ground, state, locality based, maybe there's like a power plant in like West Texas who's figured something out. Like, how should I think about that part?
Yeah, I mean, I think that most everyone in the industry would agree that progress has been a lot slower than it should be. I mean, there's no question about that. That's not to say that some companies haven't made progress, that there haven't been improvements over the course of the last 10 or 20 years. But when you look at the system as a whole, it still has a lot of issues. And I think people in the energy and climate space have been really heartened by the huge climate bill that Biden just, you know, signed into law recently. And it has a lot of money. It provides a lot of money for, you know, the acceleration of the transition to cleaner energy. The bipartisan infrastructure bill passed last year included some money for transmission, new transmission infrastructure that's needed to support the new wind and solar farms, maybe needed to replace some of the really old infrastructure that we shouldn't be relying on anymore. And it also aimed to give the federal government a larger role in being able to push these projects through. But there are real practical challenges. There's people oppose large energy infrastructure projects for a whole host of reasons. You know, it's a kind of the not in my backyard attitude. There's issues with, you know, environmental concerns, land use concerns. And so for example, building new transmission in the United States often takes more than 10 years if it gets done at all. And so that's, I mean, just one example of the reasons why progress in general has been very slow.
You know, I'm really curious about this then. You really paint a I don't want to say dire because the whole dunk on California thing's kind of like overdone, but as a non-California, I'm from Oregon and I live in Texas, so I could dunk on California from a couple different directions. It seems like things are so bad in terms of the blackouts, the wildfires, that those direct threats would overcome the local NIMBY, all those different bits. Is that just not what's actually happening?
Well, I think that, you know, I think certainly some new transmission needs to be built in California, but kind of like putting that aside, if we're talking about addressing wildfire risk, it's really a question of like two things, really. It's tree trimming and keeping trees away from lines and preventing failure of the line itself. And so you do have some opposition from homeowners who are like, do not come on my property and remove these trees. I like the trees, you know, and that's, you know, it's short-sighted when you're talking about the risk of it possibly igniting a wildfire and destroying your home or your neighbor's home or whatever. And so that's one reason why the risk is never zero. The company makes great strides in vegetation management every year. It's been sending more people out into the, you know, in bucket trucks. It's been spending more money, but you do have that sort of vein of opposition that the company has to confront. And then as it relates to trying to prevent the failures of the circuits itself, I mean, that's really on the company to do. It's on the company to decide how to maintain the distribution wires, how to maintain the transmission lines. But interestingly, within the last year, the company has come out with a new strategy to underground a huge amount of the system. If the line is underground, it pretty much cannot start a fire. It eliminates the risk. But you've got people who are, and it's going to cost at least $20 billion, though, the company estimates, even though they're trying to drive costs down. And then you have people who...
And the company pays that.
The company would pay that and recoup the cost through customers.
Okay.
So you have people who scrutinize utility spending and they say, is it really necessary for PG&E to spend $20 billion on maintaining its lines? Or should it just be doing more to be in compliance with, you know, state mandates and its own internal goals for trimming trees and making the system safer? You know, I mean, maybe the answer, like many things, the answer is somewhere in between. Maybe it doesn't need to do 10,000 miles of wire, but maybe there are circuits that really need to be buried. But if you've got critics saying you shouldn't be spending this money, that becomes a big protracted fight. It slows down the progress, you know, and it maybe calls into question whether the company can do it at all. So the company faces very, very significant challenges.
You know, in the second half, I want to actually talk about the actual sources of energy that's going through the lines. We've spoken a bit about the grid. How is the debate over nuclear and renewables and natural gas and coal? Like, how does, you know, fracking, how does that play into this dynamic? Or is it kind of like an entirely separate issue? Like, would you have these same issues if we had 100% renewable energy in the first place?
Yeah. So as it relates to the safety of the grid, it doesn't, the generation question doesn't really matter. In a direct way, it doesn't matter whether the electrons flowing from the power plants are produced by coal, gas, wind, solar. It's like, if the line is unsafe, the line is unsafe, you know? But one interesting dynamic about this story, and something that is a bit ironic, is the fact that around the 2005 timeframe, California became very intense on reducing carbon emissions by procuring huge amounts of wind and solar power. It did so by requiring the utilities to contract for certain amounts. Back in the day, wind and solar power were much more expensive than they are today. Today, wind and solar is some of the lowest cost generation out there. It wasn't always that way. So some of these early contracts that the company signed were very expensive. PG&E was spending a huge amount on this renewable electricity, and it added cost pressure. And it's one of the reasons why the company was under pressure to cut expenses over time, adding to the, you know, issues that it faced from a safety standpoint.
You know, you did a recent piece in the Journal about California and nuclear power. Could you just kind of give us an update there? Because I think that's peak. We're in kind of like a energy rethink post Ukraine invasion. So this is also a geopolitical issue. How is like the nuclear debate actually playing out in California?
So, putting aside the safety issues of the California power grid, it has been difficult for the state to manage this current period of the transition to renewable energy for a few different reasons. So it's, we've seen a lot of gas plants retire over the years. There's still a number of them, but you know, it's more reliant on wind and solar than it's ever been. And as you see more days of extreme heat, you know, exacerbated by climate change, not only in California, but throughout the West, it presents a real challenge for the grid operator in maintaining the balance of supply and demand all throughout the day for electricity. And if you have an imbalance in supply and demand in providing electricity, that's where you see the rolling blackouts. The grid operator has to call for utilities to intentionally cut power to keep supply in line with demand. And because if there's an imbalance, you risk huge system-wide failure, in which case the blackouts would last for a very long time, not just like a few hours as the grid operator calls for that to balance. Obviously, it's a last resort measure, very unpopular. And it happened in August of 2020 on some hot afternoons in which demand remained very high as solar farms began to trail off in their production naturally as the sun went down. And the state couldn't import enough power, which it has historically done during periods of supply crunches, because other states were really hot too, and those residents were using a lot of electricity, so these states had less to import. On top of that, California is consumed by a very severe drought. Hydroelectric power production has been constrained as a result, and the state's been trying very hard to bring many, many more wind and solar projects online, as well as batteries to store the output for use when production declines. But I mean, we're living in a very inflationary environment right now. The cost of raw materials have gone up. There's major supply chain challenges that have resulted in delays. And so managing the pace of this transition has been very challenging. As a result, the governor has kind of pushed this last minute effort to keep the state's last nuclear plant called Diablo Canyon online to help the state navigate this near-term challenge. It's a huge source of power. It's about 2,200 megawatts. It doesn't produce carbon. I mean, obviously, nuclear critics have concerns about a number of different things related to the plant, but carbon emissions is not one of those things. And so there's a call to extend the life for 5 years at least, maybe longer.
And you said near term. I'm curious how you think nuclear technology, maybe like new post like 80s, 90s efforts, like what role do they play in the longer term energy picture here?
With a lot of nukes, it's already steel in the ground. A lot of them were built decades ago. They proved to be very expensive and difficult to build at the time. A lot of them had major cost overruns that made nuclear power in general quite expensive, even though the operational costs of the plants were pretty low. I think that, you know, right now I completely understand the arguments to just keep these plants online instead of, you know, retiring them, because they provide significant amounts of energy carbon free. And there's a lot of challenges with managing the pace of this transition right now. But, you know, certainly, you know, in general, like the airline industry, the nuclear industry is very safe. You know, the NRC keeps really close watch over these things because, you know, the risk of a nuclear disaster is just, you have to have like zero risk tolerance, right? I mean, it's so incredibly dangerous, similar to, you know, an airline crash. And so, there are concerns. I mean, a plant meltdown would be catastrophic. And so, you know, there's also an argument for phasing these things out in the long term. It's just difficult to do so, I think, in the near term, given where we're at.
You know, the reason why this is kind of like a little area obsession for me, because within my space, a like nuclear renaissance. And if you're talking about people have NIMBY issues, mm-hmm. with, you know, transition, like straightforward power and, you know, wires, all those different bits, it seems like a serious like regeneration of like nuclear capacity would really just hit something. So I think this is something that folks should really be thinking about. I'm skeptical of states like California would even be susceptible to more nuclear power in the first place. So I'm curious if how you think those debates would play out, even if some of the like deeper questions were answered.
I think I understand your question. So in general, Diablo Canyon, which is the last nuclear plant in California, has faced a lot of opposition over the years. It's faced a lot of concern that it's close to seismic faults, could be prone to catastrophic meltdown. Obviously, that's been very closely studied by the company and the NRC. But it has real opponents. This plant has real opponents. There's a lot of people who want to see it go away. But it is interesting that this effort that the gov, you know, the governor himself is pushing this effort, saying, you know, if we don't, we really risk having major supply challenges in the coming years, and people don't like rolling blackouts either. So I think that there's tentatively enough support to get this legislation through, but it's not easy and it's not going to be popular. And the politicians who support it are going to certainly face some backlash from some of their constituents. And so, and it's also, you know, it's the issue of supply and demand on the grid is so complicated, and so few people kind of understand it holistically, that I think for some people it becomes a harder argument to stomach because they don't really realize the extent of what might happen if the plant goes away.
So three things I want to end on. So the first one would really be, you spend a lot of time in the book really describing like the inception of PG&E. Mm-hmm. So this turn of the 20th century, it's not the Wild West, obviously, but, you know, this like more open, you know, open space, open field period of energy in states like California. Are there any lessons we could take from that period that can maybe apply to reforms we need to make now? Or is it just too different of a situation? Like, reform is far different than building something in the first place.
Yeah. So from that early period, I think some of the more interesting elements was to understand kind of where the idea of the regulated monopoly came from, to understand the role the regulator was supposed to play in overseeing how the utility went about doing its business, everything from, you know, in terms of how it spent money, in terms of how it maintained the lines. And, you know, in theory, it makes a lot of sense, but I think in the rest of the book, you begin to see this breakdown on a number of different levels. I mean, first you see the efforts to deregulate the electricity industry, and it creates a lot of complexity, issues with oversight, you know, changes in the way that utilities produce and procure power. And you also see the role of the regulator break down over the years. I mean, these utilities become these behemoths that become really difficult for any given regulatory body to have adequate oversight of. You see the fact that in the case of California, the utility regulators were largely focused on these new renewable energy goals. It was kind of the sexy place to be within the regulatory agency. The safety division, meanwhile, was pretty chronically understaffed. And so, you know, it's, I think that, you know, the early history of the book is kind of meant to show, like, okay, this is what was, this is the way it was supposed to be. And here's what happened, you know? And so obviously in almost every case, you know, things that work in theory don't work in practice, but I think it maybe helps to understand, it provides some context as to why.
Then a question for the left-leaning members of the audience. Why shouldn't this all just be nationalized by the government? Not even like nationalized, like why couldn't you just treat this like maybe water or any of these, like what advantages are we getting from the status quo that make like, let's say a Tennessee Valley Authority, maybe make a little less sense across the country?
Yeah. So, I mean, the proponents of the IOU model really is that they have pretty solid access to capital and the debt and equity markets, and it's a capital intensive business as opposed to, you know, collecting all that money from taxpayers, essentially. And the other thing too is that if it was federally owned, that money does come from taxpayers. You know, I mean, I guess in some ways, some people say that might be a distinction without a difference because, you know, you're a utility customer.
It kind of feels like a tax anyways. Like, well, it was, yeah, funny. You had this quote in this book where this elderly woman says, you know, I'm paying X number of dollars for my, you know, power bill. I don't like know exactly why it's so high. Yeah. I call someone, no one tells me. Like, that seems pretty reminiscent of your taxes, like whether it's local or federal.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's right. And I mean, it's like you have to do business with your utility company. You have no choice. It doesn't matter what market structure you exist in. The utilities are the owners of the infrastructure that move power around, and they collect charges for doing so, you know? And so, you know, I think that in some ways, you know, and a question about nationalization makes sense, but it would be really expensive. It'd also just be really hard to do. I mean, on a practical level, it's like, it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle, and it's like hard to buy back this infrastructure from shareholders that have, you know, profited from this construct for so long. It's just, that is just the, you know, fact of the matter. I mean, on a more micro level, you had a few different proposals for different ownership structures for PG&E, but they all ran up against this one same issue, basically, which is that PG&E's infrastructure is not for sale. Sorry.
Didn't San Francisco try to do something?
It did. So San Francisco tried to buy the asset serving the city to make its own municipal utility. And they submitted a formal offer during PG&E's bankruptcy proceeding, and PG&E said, you know, thanks for your offer, but we're not interested in selling to you.
At the end of the day, we live in a liberal democracy. You can't, I guess there's a you know, starting with like, why can't the government just take things from private, you know, owners? Like that's there's almost like a not useful. So I guess the key takeaway here is one of like the costs and benefits of the system we have here is that a lot of this, any reforms to the system will come about from the fact that certain choices were made early 20th century. Yes. And you can't just snap your fingers to organize it in a different way. So the last question, and I kind of found this, it's kind of honestly like a depressing piece. You and one of your fellow reporters at the Journal just wrote a piece about America's like new energy crisis. And there's
that was me with my colleague, Chris. Yeah.
Yes. Sorry. I forgot Chris's name. I didn't want to be unfair. So thanks for, yeah, it was a great piece. And there was this great quote where basically, I think you quoted a former regulator who said, yeah, like no one knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
So that's a good way. I think that's both encouraging for folks who are interested in this topic. There's opportunity there, but could you really just define like what this new crisis is, how it kind of differs from the old energy crisis that you write a bit about, and then just really kind of leave it open to folks for like, what are the specific set of challenges this decade, if we're moving away from this energy abundant 2010s period to this like more volatile 2020s period?
Right. So if you think about the energy crises of the 70s, I mean, it was really, it exposed the vulnerabilities of our energy system to different geopolitical shocks. You know, the oil embargoes made it so that gas and oil prices were both very high. And that was an issue, but it was kind of an easy to understand issue. You know, it was kind of like a basic supply demand issue. And nobody liked, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, in terms of all of the pieces of infrastructure that use these fuels, it created very, you know, widespread economic challenges. But once again, I mean, the root of the problem was relatively simple to understand. Here, you've got the convergence of so many different challenges. You have the challenge of managing the pace of the energy transition, as we were talking about earlier, because as you add more wind and solar, you have the potential for greater fluctuations, and it makes it harder to make sure that that constant state of equilibrium is maintained. You also have climate change putting new stress on a system that's already very old and becoming increasingly vulnerable to failure. You have the fact that between, you know, the war in Ukraine and, you know, Europe attempting to reduce its reliance on Russia almost wholesale, you've got, you know, a lot of our natural gas that we produce here is being sent abroad, you know, raising prices here, you know, so electricity prices, by virtue of the fact that a lot of electricity is produced with natural gas, is going up at a time when utilities have a lot of spending to do in order to prepare for this future of greater electricity demand and climate change. And so, you know, just the challenges are so multifaceted that it's harder to have a holistic understanding of what's going on, and even harder to propose solutions that can like really address every element. So I think we're in for a rocky few years, honestly, and hopefully some of the supply and you know, on top of that, supply chains issues that have made new construction of new energy sources even more challenging. So hopefully some of those challenges can be alleviated in the near term as supply chains begin to normalize. Hopefully, I mean, maybe we see a stabilization in gas prices, but it's so dependent on what's going on in Europe and Ukraine and other things. So it's tough. It's tough to understand and tough to address.
So the takeaway should be that this is not, I guess the key difference here is that this isn't like the 70s where you can just say, here's like the five, and this isn't quite like perfectly historical, but there's like no equivalent of here's just like the 5-point plan.
Right.
We're out of the crisis. There's this like super intermingled bit that we're just going to have to deal with over the next
decade. Yeah, things stabilized in the 80s, right? But I don't think that we're going to see this stabilize anytime soon. I think, you know, certain elements of the challenge will be more easily addressed than others. And, you know, perhaps we get lucky on some fronts, but I mean, it's hard to see an end to this from where we stand now.
On that note, I think that's an excellent place to leave the podcast. But once again, I think it's interesting when you have spaces that are so intermingled like this, because it means that there could be input from different sectors. This isn't purely like a state issue. It's not purely a federal issue. There's complicated bits there. Catherine, could you shout out the book, It's in our bookshop. It's available. I personally listened to it on Audible. It was a really enjoyable listen. But can you shout the book out to listeners who want to learn more?
It's called California Burning, all of PG&E and what it means for America's power grid. And I hope everyone enjoys it and finds it worthwhile.
For sure. Catherine, thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.